Monster Man, special episode, Creatures of the Isle of Dread. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Andrew. If you'd like to be like Andrew and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, not only will you get the opportunity to choose a topic for your own special episode, but you'll also get access to all the benefits for other levels, including monthly bonus content, which is coming out this week, sorry for the delay, and all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. If you have recently signed up and I haven't got in touch with you about choosing your episode topic, please check the email address that you use for the Patreon, because that's where I'll be sending the message. So, Andrew, thank you once again for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. So, Andrew has asked me to talk about the Rakasta, who are monsters from the classic module, The Isle of Dread. And I have decided to expand this topic out into looking at the kind of monstrous, like, ecosystem is the wrong word, but the way that the different kind of animal people monsters in the Isle of Dread interact with each other. Because I think that this module, although it is presented in a very simple way, has got a lot of interesting thought that's gone into creating it, even if maybe in a modern version of the same module, some of the things would have been explained a little more explicitly. On the other hand, maybe I'm seeing castles in the clouds, I don't know. Let's take a look and you can judge for yourselves. First, a little historical background. Module X1, The Isle of Dread, is a very well-known module for basic D&D. And the reason for that is that it was included in both versions of the Expert set. So both during the kind of like BX edition and during Beckme. Basically, like, you don't need to know the details of this, but we're talking about the early to mid-1980s. The original version was written in 1981. The second version, which is the one that I have, came out in 1983, and it was designed by David Zeb Cook and Tom Moldvay. Isle of Dread has the distinction of being one of the first, if not the first, TSR D&D modules to focus mainly on the outdoors and wilderness adventuring. If you looked at the basic set, you would have seen that it was mainly confined to the dungeon, and the kind of overworld stuff was gradually introduced in the Expert set. So this is sort of meant to be, or certainly the reason for its inclusion in the box set, is that it's meant to be kind of a worked example of what an outdoor wilderness adventuring environment can be. And I think that this scenario was probably quite eye-opening to a lot of people in the early 1980s. It is generally pretty positively remembered, and that is partly because it kind of lacks a structure. It has a through line, which is that you're supposed to go to this island looking for this ruined temple, but of course it's full of monsters. But I think that for most people, the main appeal of the Isle of Dread is not even the temple, but actually the bit where you're just kind of wandering around the island before you approach the ruined temple. You're given a blank map of the island, and you basically kind of fill it in as you go through the jungle. So it really gets, you get to show off the wilderness exploration rules, makes you think about navigating an imagined space. And I think when you get to the various points of interest in the landscape, that's quite satisfying. So I think a lot of people's good memories of this are actually the middle bit, and that is where the three creatures that I want to talk about in today's episode turn up. Monsters that appeared in the various modules for basic D&D were later reprinted in the creature catalog, and we took a look at the first version of that from 1986, back in season 4 of Monster Man. So that means that the three monsters that I'm going to be talking about today, I have already covered. And their monster entries are not very different between the two publications. So the monster entries in some cases from Isle of Dread are repeated verbatim or almost verbatim in Creature Catalog. Although I do think that the inability to capture like the mounts and special equipment of some enemies is spelled out more explicitly in Creature Catalog. So if you want to go back and listen to those episodes about the Phanaton, the Rakasta, and the Irania from season 4, you can go do that. In fact, the Phanaton and the Rakasta are in the same episode. I will say that although the entries themselves are very similar, I do think that these monsters take on a fuller and more interesting aspect when we look at them in their original context. So although the Isle of Dread is a sandboxy kind of scenario, the island constrains sandbox activity in kind of the way that a dungeon structure flowchartifies exploration a little bit. You start almost certainly by landing at the most like accessible part of the island, which is the village of Tanaroa. And if you've been listening to Patron Deities, you might know that Tanaroa comes from related words in a number of Polynesian languages, which are in turn related to Kanaloa, the god of the sea in Hawaiian mythology. A lot of the times, words from like other Polynesian languages are more recognizable in Hawaiian. If you just think that T in many of those other languages becomes K in Hawaiian and R becomes L. So we've seen examples of things like the Hawaiian system of kapu is taboo in other Polynesian languages. Not all of them, but I mean, I don't speak any of them, so don't take my word for anything. Anyway, just a fun bit of trivia there connecting the two podcasts. Once you have landed in these villages, it's nice actually, because there's a little bit of separation. You know, there is a border, a wall between the human inhabited villages of the coast and the jungle interior of the island. So you get to meet these comparatively normal humans. They do have some odd practices involving zombies, but for the most part, they're just regular folks. And they will tell you that the interior of the island is dangerous, although they do go in there from time to time looking for resources that they don't have. In particular, there's some tar pits. And they use the naturally occurring tar for like waterproofing and things like that. So you can hire a guide to take you part of the way, creating a sort of transitional moment where you're still a little bit in the society of the humans. While you are on the island, there are obviously random encounter tables, and those can produce meetings with either the Irania, the Phanaton, or the Rakasta. There are also physical locations that represent their like lairs, camps, or villages. And probably, if you take like what I think is probably the most... Well, having said that, it's the most direct path, but actually I think, you know, many people might like work their way around the outside or whatever. But if you take the most direct path, the first of these locations that you're going to run into is the Rakasta camp. So as I said back in season 4, the Rakasta are tiger-riding nomadic cat people. They are described as proud and barbaric. They like to get in there and mix it up. Like they have regular claws. They know that those don't work very well in an actual fight. So they have artificial metal claws that they wear over them, but they still prefer to fight with their claws. And they're kind of martial elite, ride around on big saber-toothed tigers, which in a way is silly, but one of the things I like about the Rakasta is that although they are animal people, they are very much not animals. You know, if you visit their camp, you can see that it is actually pretty luxurious in places. They may be barbarians, but they live in barbaric splendor. Not very much is said about their culture or character, but I think we could infer from the description of their camp and from their description that they are, you know, proud warriors who value strength and skill at arms. And their alignment is neutral. You might be able to talk to them. You might even be able to secure their help, although... You know, maybe not. But one can imagine that the Rakasta would respond well to certain types of persuasion. Like, if you try to impress them, they might go for that. The Rakasta don't have a specific objective. They just kind of move around the island, like moving from hunting ground to hunting ground, moving from campsite to campsite. And this is where they happen to be at the moment. They're kind of the background radiation of the island in terms of intelligent animal people. One of the things that people have said about the Tabaxi, who are by now certainly like the most common cat people in Dungeons and Dragons, they've kind of taken off in 5th edition. But one of the things that people have said about the Tabaxi is that their creator, Lawrence Schick, intended them to be similar to the Xinti from the works of Larry Niven. So Larry Niven's Ringworld books and a bunch of other science fiction short stories and collections and novels or whatever feature the Xinti, who are a sort of honor-bound warrior culture. Well, I guess it's not that warlike, but they're very into their sense of themselves as like heroes. That's how they describe themselves. And because Niven wrote for the Star Trek animated series, the Xinti exists within the Star Trek universe as well. But it's very hard to see how the Tabaxi are connected to the Xinti other than that they are cat people. I would almost say that the tiger-like, warlike Rakasta are maybe even a little bit more like the Xinti than the Tabaxi are. Certainly, when I think of the Tabaxi, the image in my mind is that they are cats, that they are like small cats. Whereas, of course, the Rakasta are kind of tiger-like. I do think that the association between the Rakasta and tigers makes sense. You know, we have a tendency to assign animals and indeed entire species sort of personalities in our heads, personalities that maybe they don't necessarily have. You know, the good example of this is kind of the noble and brave lion, which like is not particularly how lions behave. They're just impressive. They're just the largest land predator you were going to find. Similarly, I think with tigers, we kind of both admire and fear them. They are symbols of kind of pitiless wilderness. Blake's tiger is a symbol of a wild and dangerous creation, as opposed to a meek and gentle one. Did he who made the lamb make thee? I think that choosing the tiger for this creature really sends a message about what kind of thing we're looking for. It's also sort of thematically on brand. The Isle of Dread is a very pulpy setting. It's full of dinosaurs and troglodytes and Neanderthals and ruins, and there's a dragon in there, and etc. It's very kind of Tarzan-y, I guess. And that's something that we observed in season 4, the way in which there's more of a kind of pulp adventure story feeling than a high fantasy feeling in basic D&D. So viewed in the context of a monster book, the Rakasta definitely read like one of those why couldn't this just be a human monsters. But I think here it makes sense because you want to present the areas of the isle beyond Tanaroa as weird and primeval and mysterious. And some of that will go away if there were just communities of humans living there, even if they were like under siege from monsters. This is meant to be a strange wild place, and the people who can survive in it are strange wild people. You know, this is meant to be a jungle full of like natural hazards. So animal people kind of reinforce that idea. It makes sense not to have humans who would make the environment feel more familiar. After the Rakasta, the next creature you're likely to meet geographically are the Phanaton. The Phanaton are cute little monkey lemur, kind of halfling-sized fellas. They live in a treetop village, which is described and mapped, despite the fact that there isn't really all that much of interest there. They are the traditional enemies of the Irania, but this is not really discussed in either the Phanaton village or Phanaton sections. You sort of have to read the Irania bit in order to understand the relationship between the two. Maybe I just missed it, you know, but I thought I looked pretty carefully and didn't see it. As soon as I put this up, someone will point out that there's a bit in the Phanaton village that my eyes just slid over that says that they're like under attack from the Irania. I feel like this is a scenario that you sort of have to pore over. And again, I think that's a very typical attitude toward such scenarios in the 80s. I don't think this is something that you could pick up and run immediately. At least, I mean, I'm not saying you can't. Let me walk that back a little bit. I don't think that you couldn't, but I do think that to get the most out of it, you need to identify relationships between its various parts, which are not necessarily obvious from the descriptions of those parts, or at least not all of them. I do feel like my relationship to these texts has changed a lot since I was younger. Then I certainly felt like I had the time to meticulously study. You know, I read old issues of White Dwarf and old rule books and old comic books and books over and over and over and over again. There are books that I don't particularly like that when I was a kid, I read 10 or 12 times because I read very quickly and I had pretty bad insomnia. I think the Phanaton-Irania conflict is quite interesting, but it's not very visible on the page. And the Phanaton village by itself is not exciting at all. Like, the NPCs don't even have names. There's not particularly anything to do. There's not really any reason to visit the Phanatons other than that it is a safe place to sleep, I suppose. You know, if you manage to befriend the Phanatons, that's very useful. But again, not like mentioned or suggested. There's not much guide to role-playing the Phanaton, even though their personalities and their interaction with the PCs is probably quite important. So talking about the Phanaton, I mentioned their enemies, the Irania, who are the next monsters on the list. The Irania are horrid. They are giant pony-sized magic spiders with big lumpy brains. They got some bugbear minions and they build like web houses full of magic items. They have a lot of magic items because they sort of collect them from people they kill, but I don't think they can really use them. Like, they don't have hands or anything. So there are many fewer Irania, at least in the Irania lair area than there are Phanaton, but they're individually much more powerful. Because they can climb trees easily and have spiderwebs and so on, the Urania live pretty high up in the canopy, and it's hard to see that a party who just passed through this hex would necessarily find them. I think you would sort of have to be looking for them, which might mean that you've been told about them by the Phanaton, or that you've previously run into them as a wandering monster encounter and kind of followed them home. You know, I have to admit, reading this is kind of making me want to run the Isle of Dread, although ideally I guess I'd want to get my hands on the BX version. The version I have is the Bekmi version. That's the second version of the text. But the rule set that I play that is most compatible is Old School Essentials, which is derived from, and in many cases identical to, BX. Anyway, whatever. The idea of kind of putting all these pieces together, of thinking, hey, we found out that the Urania and the Phanaton are fighting, is there a way that we can use that fact to our advantage? That's very enjoyable to me, and I like the idea of, you know, you can develop these things more effectively when you have as a fallback position the idea that it is just fun to map the jungle. So far, we have three different animal type monsters, or animal people monsters, and I think that they are, you know, if you read them individually, the Urania have some, like, mechanical gimmickry and a powerful visual, but the Phanaton and the Rakasta are fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with them. I think that where they shine a little bit more is when you put them into their context. If you think about them as existing in this area together with all the various, like, dinosaurs, gargoyles, troglodytes, Neanderthals, and what have you, then I think they work. They're kind of the main groups that you could meet and talk to in this part of the island. Each of them is tied to an animal that evokes the kind of emotional response that Cook and Moldvay are hoping we will have for these groups. So for example, the Rakasta are tigers, who we see as proud and strong, but also dangerous and aggressive. The Phanaton are monkeys or lemurs, and they are fun and charming, but maybe not like the most disciplined or efficient people in the world. And the Urania are spiders, which so many people are just, you know, repelled by. Each of them is free to play any kind of role in the campaign, but broadly speaking, I think that the Rakasta are like a background threat, the Urania are full antagonists, and the Phanaton are helpful, friendly locals. They're certainly not threatening. And I think those animal choices act as almost sort of signifiers that help the PCs understand how they're gonna be relating to these groups. Another thing that the animal-human hybrid monster does is it kind of signifies a liminal state. So this isn't 100% right. Like, there are more than just three areas of the Isle of Dread, but you can think of the sort of main activities of the Isle of Dread is being divided into three parts. The first is Tanaroa and the surrounding villages. So there you're interacting with humans. They're doing very normal, like, mundane, everyday stuff, right? When you arrive, one of the first things that they want to talk to you about is trade and business. So they're very tied into the mundane world. At the end, you have the Ruined Temple and the Kopru, who are super evil, mind-controlling bad guys, and they're very much intended to be like frightening and alien and weird. And then in the middle zone, you have, among others, the Rakasta, the Phanaton, and the Urania, whose animal forms I think are there to kind of tell you that you're not in Kansas anymore. So the inhabitants of the jungle kind of support, I mean, they support the module's core activity, which is jungle exploration, but they also provide a kind of transitional or intermediary zone between the social and political gameplay of Tanaroa and the more puzzle and action-oriented gameplay of the temple. So I think somewhere in the middle are, you know, the Rakasta as rivals and the Urania as targets. And I think that when you think about that, the creatures are as complex as they need to be for their role in this scenario. And this is what I said about a lot of monsters from the creature catalog that seemed underwhelming to me at the time. You know, I thought it may very well be that you just have to see these in context. It'll stop being just another bag of hit points and become
something that has a role in, you know, a series of relationships or a, for want of a better word, story. Now, I do think that maybe that could have been made more explicit. Like, the thing is, I am just inferring this from the text, these relationships between the different factions within the Isle of Dread. I don't know that they're necessarily intended to be written that way. It just seems that that is how they are likely to shake out. So perhaps it's true that the Isle of Dread could maybe do, especially for first-time GMs, with explaining a little bit more how to run these creatures in their environment. But it's also possible that it doesn't do that because I'm just doing that thing that people do, which is to assume that the people who came before them shared their preferences. So maybe all of this is just castles in the clouds and you are just meant to butcher this village full of little monkey people and take the depressingly small chest of silver coins hidden under the leader's bed. But I think that although maybe they need to be explained a bit more, I don't think the things in themselves are bad. And I said they were a bit bare bones, and I do still sort of agree with that. But I also think that, firstly, that simplicity is a little misleading because actually it's not them as individuals or as particular species that are interesting, but the relationship between them, which is in that kind of undescribed void in the scenario. And secondly, also, I think they are as complicated as they need to be. They've got a little bit of not being normal monsters. It just to give them a little thrill of the exotic as you explore this remote jungle island. But they don't have so much gimmickry that they're going to, like, clutter up the book or that it's going to be hard for the GM to learn. And that is, I presume, because they're not really expected to come back. Although, in fact, the Rakasta are in 6 or 7 D&D modules. Including one I saw when I was younger called Rage of the Rakasta. Since it had a tiger person on it, at least I think it did, and it was called Rage of the Rakasta, I assumed it meant Rage of the Rakshasa. That seemed out of character with what Rakshasa are like. Anyway, so yeah, that's what I think about the Isle of Dread. I think it's deceptively simple. I think it could be described in more detail, but maybe it's not meant to be. You know, maybe I'm imagining all that stuff into it. But I feel like I'm not, because I feel like the design of the Phanaton, the Irania, and the Rakasta makes it pretty clear that that's how they're meant to relate to each other because of the, like, the choice of animals. Not that anyone ever said, hey, we have these noble but violent characters, let's make them tigers. That will convey the correct attitude of violence and nobility. It's just that the people creating these things also share those assumptions. And when they wanted to create noble but violent, kind of proud, barbaric characters, they chose tigers to represent them because that's what a tiger means. All right, now that I've told you what a tiger means, that's about all the time that we have for today. Andrew, thank you once again for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, please remember that if you want to be like Andrew and get your own special episode, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or if you prefer to pledge at a lower level, just $2 gets you all the patron deities you can eat. Well, you can't eat any of it, but it gets you all the patron deities you can listen to. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And we're going to be taking a look at the numerous entries for mammals, and then moving on to the Man Scorpion, which is a creature from Sumerian mythology, but which I cannot stop thinking is a ripoff of RuneQuest. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.